Having the opportunity to talk on such a nice conference. I think Sabine has shown the details of her theory in enough detail so that I'll probably not use a lot of time on explaining it again, because I think all of you got by now what the idea is. What I want to spend some time though on is why particle physicists are wondering about the generalized uncertainty principle, if the Planck scale is really a Planck scale. And the idea is basically the model of large extra dimensions. The setup is, in this model, the few things you have to accept is first, that there are extra spatial dimensions, and second, that only gravity lives in these dimensions, while our standard model particles are living on a submanifold. So imagine a setup, I'll just try it. So we live probably here, and this is one of the extra dimensions that is compactified on a torus with some radius r. And this is one of the dimensions that we see that is extended to infinity. Of course, since we observe Newton's law, it is clear that these dimensions must be compactified, because otherwise we would see another dependence of the gravitational potential on the distance. When you look, I'm trying to do this very fast with a simple toy model. When you look at the gravitational potential in higher dimensions, it follows from Gauss' law that the gravitational potential should look something like a gravitational constant, mass over r to the 1 plus b, where b is the number of extra dimensions. Whereas, when you look just at our three dimensions, three special dimensions, that is how you take this. You just see a line, basically, so that you're on a radius that is, if you look at distances that are far bigger than the compactification radius of those extra dimensions, you just see the usual gravitational potential. Okay, the question is basically, what's the relation between the real fundamental gravitational constant and the constant we see? So you could estimate that from some kind of boundary condition at the compactification radius. I mean, of course, what you really have to do is you have to put mass here, and have to do a Schwarzschild solution in higher dimensions and look at it when it's compactified in the torus. This is a kind of a simple way to look at it. And at the compactification radius, you should have something like df m over compactification radius r1 plus d equals this. And from that, you get a relation between those two gravitational constants. When you look at the dimensions, this gravitational constant
usual gravitational constant is 1 over like mass squared. And this fundamental gravitational constant must have some dimensions like mass 2 plus d. And from this, it actually follows that the fundamental mass scale should have a relation with this, with the black mass. So basically, the idea is that gravity is strong. You could have quite a low value for this fundamental mass scale of gravity, but you just don't observe it just because of the geometry of the space-time. So if you take some complexification radius, well, larger than the Planck scale here, you can have a low fundamental scale for gravity, but still observe a weak gravitational constant in, at distances above the complexification radius. That's the whole idea of logic, certainly. The point is, I want to stress that there are models that can bring the fundamental gravity, that can make gravity strong. And there is the possibility that the Planck scale that we observe is just a geometrical relic of well, or it's just due to the geometry of the space-time and is not a fundamental constant. That's the point. And if you have such a lower fundamental scale, that means if you have strong gravity at small scales, you have a plethora of all kinds of effects that have been looked on. The most obvious being, of course, the modification of the gravitational law at small scales. This has only been looked at about the submillimeter range. So no one knows, actually, that Newton's law is preserved at distances below about a millimeter. I think they are down to 10th of a millimeter or something. What else can you do? You can, of course, have gravitational interactions. You can produce gravitons if your center of mass energy is higher than this fundamental scale. You could, from this, have a modified, an enhanced supernova cooling. You could have missing energy in collider events. You could have graviton contributions in loop diagrams. You could have, you could have black hole production, because when you look at the Schwarzschild radius in higher dimensions, strictly the mass black hole, it looks something like this. Okay, this is some numerical term here.
C is the E minus 3.
C is the number of extra dimensions. You see that the gravitational, that the Schwarzschild radius grows dramatically with a lower fundamental scale. So there have been quite some papers on black hole production and flyers and the like.
You mentioned supernova cooling as a constraint. Do you remember the?
There is a constraint, actually.
Is it higher than the inverse square law?
I know there is a constraint, but I don't know the number.
It depends on how many degrees of freedom you allow to evaporate into the, or how exactly you constrain evaporation into the bulk. I think the most.
Well,
it depends on, as far as I recall, on how how much you get back into the gamma ray background out of the bulk. So you, I think the strongest constraint is actually indirect from the supernova evaporation. That somehow the bulk then back reacts and produces a gamma ray background. But then if you, for the tightest of these scenarios, you get the stronger constraints and the direct gravitational measurement. As far as I recall, but that's already status of 3 years ago. Perhaps something else has changed.
The constraints from supernova are pretty tight, and they are definitely tighter than those from submillimeter measurements. Most importantly, because the submillimeter measurements only give you constraints in number of extra dimensions fixed to it, because they just don't get down to very small distances. Mm-hmm. And the constraints from supernova are especially tight for a large number of extra dimensions. Like if you go up to 4 or 5 extra dimensions, you find that MF has to be larger than 5 to 10 TeV, so this is pretty tight. But then this is of course true, it depends on the details that you put into your computation.
Okay.
What about post-Newtonian effects at larger length scales?
Well, this doesn't modify it, of course. There is no modification of Newton's law at large distances.
Right, but there's going to be some gravitational theory on the brain.
Yeah.
And this will have some kind of next to Newtonian order effects.
Oh, okay. So, yes, that's what you would see when you come into the range near this compactification radius. So some leading order correction or something to Newton's law. Yeah, that's true. But, well, at the moment they don't see it in those submillimeter gravitational law experiments.
Yeah, but what about
I think on the log scale there is exponentially suppressed. There's a Yukawa type coupling that exponentially suppresses those things, but they are there in principle.
Okay. Now, if you have a lower fundamental scale and gravity is strong, then of course this minimal length that's being spoken about and revealed this UV cutoff is of course far earlier than at a Planck scale. And the question is now, can we see it in particle physics experiments? Or can we see it in experiments? Or can we use experiments to constrain the parameter of the modified uncertainty principle? Can we use the uncertainty principle to constrain this parameter? Okay, and I'm going to some thing I have the first step, which is the geomagnetic moment of muons. As you might remember, the geomagnetic moment is the factor between the spin and the magnetic moment of the lepton. And in the normal Dirac theory, it comes out that it is 2, actually, and you get loop contributions from QD. You can calculate all that, and you can also take the modified Dirac equation that Sabine showed, which looks like you have this function P of K here. And you look up at the first order corrections of this, because of course this is a low energy effect, you look at the first order corrections to this Dirac equation, and look what corrections do you get to this geomagnetic moment. And the corrections turn out to be of this kind. Where M mass of the muon.
Is
that a one-third in front of that?
Yeah, okay, this factor depends actually, of course, on the function you use. On the specific function you use for P of K. This is basically the factor. The one-third appears when you use a hyperbolic tangent for this function. Of course, you should add a factor here because you don't know the exact form of the function. If you take this, well, the first question you could raise is, okay, even if this is as low as 1 TeV, how could you see something in a low energy experiment? But then you look at the experimentalist data, and is there another quarter X views? And it's like the following. The experimental data on the journal at the moment, and they define factor A needle, which is P minus 2 over 2. This is, let's write it down, 0.8 plus minus 6 times 10 to the minus 10. And this is their error. So this is never incredibly exact. And the same goes for the theoretical value, which is they get two values because they
just true both the muon and the electron.
This is for the muon. This is for the muon. And then the theoretical data differs because they need to get a panel on the. The hadronic contributions, which is actually the uncertainty of the spectral functions that of the hadronic contributions that spoils this this result.
So can you say a word about the experiments that get this precision?
Yes.
But is the lifetime of the muon does not limit the precision?
They actually look at the, this is an experiment performed at the BNL, and they, as far as I know, they insert muons into a synchrotron, and they look at the decay of these muons, and the direction of the decay products of those muons is related to the spin. Or to the angular momentum of those muons, and that's how they measure.
So they actually use the peak
muon. Yes. Yes.
There's the experiment, if I recall, it's done so that the muon goes back and forth and down and back and forth, a magnetic trap, and the spin recesses after a certain number of trips.
Okay.
And if the muon has a lifetime, then it's going to be. And uncertainty in the experiment, so I guess that's incorporated in the level.
I figure.
Yeah, that's right. You should have wrong exponentials there.
Oh, sorry. I was. Still, you see that the numbers don't match up, which is. they're still discussing about whether numbers don't match up.
So it's better for the electron than it is for the muon.
This is for the muon.
Yeah, I know, but the agreement between theory and experiment is better for the electron.
Yeah.
Can you say a word about the theoretical? What they have done? That is, I heard about the problem with QCD more than
yes.
QED.
Yeah. Okay. Of course, for the theoretical value, they you can calculate the QED contributions. Of course, you can. Calculate all loops, but you have a problem with the QCD contribution, for the hadronic contribution, because you have to rely on experimental input, that is the spectral functions. And actually, they give two values for those. One where they get the spectral functions from tau decay, and one where they get the spectral functions from Something else. I just don't recall at the moment.
But at which order the QCD start to affect?
I can
the unknown QCD part, people call the delicate QCD part.
I can probably show you the number. I mean, it starts about here. It's where the uncertainty comes in. And that's actually why I tried to be conservative and said, okay, they are matching to the order of about 10 to the minus 8. Let's say this. Okay?
Well, I mean, that error is 111 on the last three digits.
11.
Oh, it's 11.1.
Yeah.
So it's on the last two digits.
Yes. And what I know at least is that this factor has to be smaller than 10 to the minus 8. That's the conservative assumption. And when you do that, and you use the 1/3, which is, of course, which is you should think about because you don't know exactly the function, then you get constraint on this, which lies about 500 G, which is quite nice, because that's in the order of constraints. Which this lies in the order of constraints they get from high energy experiments.
And is that a better? But what's the analogous bound for the electron?
The bound is, of course, worse because the electron mass is a lot lower.
Smaller, so it's higher than 500.
Yeah. No,
it's lower than 500.
Lower than 500, far lower. I mean, muon mass is about.
Yeah, it's lower than 500.
MeV, Fermi, MeV. Okay. Okay.
Can you say again? But would those modifications go in the right direction?
Actually, I didn't look at that because of the uncertainties they have in the theoretical value. They don't even agree on that they defer. That's the point, actually. I'm waiting since 2 years for better data, but it doesn't come. The most actual data they have is still from 2004. Mm-hmm. So probably we'll see when they release better data.
If you make the first order approximation, can you slide after the report so you see the contribution? So there, where the 1 over 3 is, there should actually be a factor of order 1. And this factor could be positive or negative. Uh-huh. So this is this first order contribution, so that there should be an alpha.
Cannot be positive or negative.
Huh?
It can't be positive or negative. I mean, you know that this function starts to decrease.
Yeah. But what does it say about the first order?
Yeah, the first order.
So can you say worldwide the correction is quadratic in M over M and not linear?
That's actually because this function is uneven. Because you don't have first order correction, you don't have a first order correction. It's the second order correction. The first one that.
And it's always negative.
Yeah, that's what we were just.
Yeah, I know. I mean, is that generic regard for all the models? It's always got. It's got to always be negative.
Actually, that's my impression, but Sabina just said otherwise.
You think not?
You're saying because the first order approximation has to jump.
I mean, if it weren't negative, that would mean that to first order this function would rise and then go flat, which is a bit unnatural. But, well, of course, in general, yeah.
So it is permitted?
Yes.
So the sign's function
yes.
depends on what you choose. For.
Okay. What else did I talk about? Again, when we talk about black holes. But it does something.
Are you, like, is your friend that that's the tightest bound in particles?
No, that's not the claim. I'm just saying that this bound is of the order of, the particle data booklet says that the current bound on the F is 1.1 kV. That's it. See, the nice thing is that even with such a low energy experiments, you can get a bound of that order, which is nice.
And where does the 1.1 come from?
Oh, this is kind of the average they build from all bounds they accept. What's the
presumably some class experiments that are?
I think it's. My educated guess would be that it's from Rick, from some missing energy experiments or whatever, but I don't know. Do you know?
Well, usually the tightest constraints come from electrical corrections, like virtual contributions,
okay.
But I'm not absolutely completely sure where that one comes from. Well, it's true, they usually combine several data.
Okay. Quickly running out of time. This plot is a plot of the Casimir effect, actually, where we have calculated the difference between the vacuum expectation value of free space and the space between two plates, where you have only certain modes allowed. And you see those wiggles. Those wiggles, of course, come because we take the assumptions of two plates that are fixed at a certain position, which, with a modified uncertainty principle, of course, makes no sense. You can flatten that out by that curve. You see the wiggles essentially come from when another mode fits between the plates. That, that's not related to experiment, it's just a calculation we have done. What I want to come to next is black hole production. There has been much debate about black hole cross-section you should assume for particle collisions. And the best bet is still, you're right here. Oh, it's a row. Okay. No, it's there. I think it's. The best bet is still pi r squared, where r is the Schwarzschild radius. So basically, when. Okay. So basically, when you have two particles that come together and they come closer than the Schwarzschild radius of their rest mass, of their center of mass, then they form a black hole. That's the idea. And this is the plot you showed, actually, on your talk. I don't remember.
This? No, this is your
plot. No, the plot of the mass
differential cross section.
This is a plot of the differential cross section of black holes with and without modified uncertainty principle. So you see here basically this is the part next that is the part of the
of the momentum of the center of mass energy that goes into the black hole. And you see that high energy black holes are strongly suppressed. The high mass black holes are strongly suppressed, which you see here, with a modified uncertainty principle. And what I show you now is black hole production for a neutrino nucleon cross section from cosmic neutrinos. What you see here is the neutrino energy in GeV, and this is the cross section in centimeter squared. And what you see here is that's the standard model. That's the neutrino nucleon cross section. Neutral current, charge current. Look at the charge current. And then you switch on extra dimensions, basically. And what happens is that you get a contribution from black hole production, which becomes dominant like that.
So you use alternatively extra dimension and modify this modify the normal
kind. Yeah, it's very different. Generalized.
Is it equivalent for you?
No. Basically,
because two slides before you had not extra dimension.
No.
As the source of the modifier.
The point is,
and now you're back to extra dimension.
Okay. No, the point is, I'm looking at the generalized uncertainty principle, but I need extra dimensions to make the Planck mass small. To make the Planck mass small. Because...
So you combine it?
Yes. That's the idea.
You have two parameters then.
You have the numbers. You have the number of extra... Yeah, you have...
Think of it.
Yeah.
The number of extra dimensions, the new...
I mean, of course,
and then the beta.
In particle physics, it makes no sense to look at the coarse space time if the Planck mass is really at the Planck mass. And the point I want to make is that
I think the first point is whether you actually have more free gravity. But I think if I understand you correctly, you only justify a large Planck length, by appealing to higher dimensions. You're not actually calculating it.
No. That's the point.
So what is
mean for the black hole production? It turns out that the cross section is independent of the number of x dimensions. It varies very, very slowly with
yeah.
the. What depends on the number of x dimensions are the evaporation.
Still, there is a combined effect. Can you go two slides just to see what was written?
Sure.
What did you?
There?
ML.
Minimal length
is to do with extra dimensions?
No.
So this is exactly what I'm missing.
How
the radius of the extra dimension is related to the minimal length? Are they two independent parameters?
Yes.
So,
No, they're not. You see,
why?
Here. The radius, this is the Planck mass we observe. This is the radius of the extra dimensions, and this is the fundamental mass scale, which is 1 over the fundamental length scale. That's the idea.
So, why the minimum length is related to R? That R?
No.
But in this equation, you have three parameters, the MF, the R, and the D, which are related by this equation, so you are left with two. And in the case for the black hole production, it turns out that the details are actually independent of the D.
No, but there's not necessarily a minimal length on the in the long dimension given that, right? You can have a compactified dimension huge there, but there's not necessarily from that model a minimum length. I think that's what...
I still don't understand what minimum length you need on that transparency.
It means that you have
the presence of R in extra dimension?
No, it means that you have a generalized uncertainty principle.
So this model is irrelevant for that calculation.
Irrelevant?
No, it's not. It's not irrelevant in the sense that if you don't have large extra dimensions, you don't have like whole productions in neutrino nuclear collisions.
So
the point is.
You have to tell us two lengths, clearly.
So there are two length scales, I agree with you.
Yeah, I can go and...
But they are related, the length scale of the extra dimensions.
How do you relate them? Can you explain to us how do you relate these?
It's just saying that the fundamental Planck scale is lower than what we observe. Does it,
because of the extra dimensions, right?
Yeah.
So NF is the mass scale, which is much lower than 10 to the 19.
So probably there's an assumption.
If you want to take the phenomenon of data, you have to choose two dimensions.
Yeah, but I think the assumption is there's probably, you're taking the optimum assumption, probably the minimum or NF can be to do that calculation, and then you're putting in some assumption about the minimum length, but they're not necessarily related.
If you make the phenomenology especially,
yeah.
Let's say it's 1, the ratio of the 2.
Yeah.
You mean that the inverse of the fundamental scale could be something different than...
If you make the phenomenology, certainly. Decide it's 1 or pi or 2
pi,
who decides?
Sure, that's true, mm-hmm. But in the first order approximation there is a parameter of order 1, so you don't need to take the parameter.
No, but the phenomenology might change with this dimensionless ratio, which has been apparently chosen to be 1.
Well, yes, but this is the same as a varying MF.
What is, to get the dotted curve, what assumption was made about MF?
Yeah, so what is MF in this plot?
What's MF in the dotted curve?
This is 1 TeV in this plot.
All right, and it's 1 TeV for the solid line, too.
Yes,
that's what I said. They're choosing the optimum assumption for MF, and then you're tuning the minimal length. I mean, if minimal length were shorter and shorter, that solid curve...
Okay, but that boils down to the general question. If you put into your generalized uncertainty principle, is your parameter there, is it the Planck mass, or is it some factor times the Planck mass?
Well,
this is the same. This is the same question.
The latter, right? Is it your minimal length some factor times the Planck mass?
That's the assumption of extra dimensions.
Not necessarily. You don't need extra dimensions to have a minimum length.
No, of course.
You don't need a minimum length.
The point I will make is that that if you have a lowered fundamental scale, then you have an increased minimal length.
Yes, okay.
Sure.
That's not necessary. I mean, I agree you can do it, but it's not. I agree with Bruno. I don't think it's necessary. It's possible, but it's not demanded.
Aren't dimensions just a scenario where it is happening?
Right.
Just a scenario.
I mean, there are other scenarios where you can.
How do you make the phenomenology with one parameter if you have two? There is a reduction.
Well, one parameter. No, but Bruno, one parameter has been chosen for optimality. That's the dotted curve, and they're saying let's keep that parameter, and then let's see what minimal length does, and it suppresses.
Optimality.
Well, I mean, we know the lower bound is 1.1 TeV, so let's assume it has that lower bound and see what happens. That's what I understand is being done, and then from that I'll say, okay, now we'll put in the minimal length hypothesis and see what that does. But there's presumably a choice that's been made there, since you could modify. I mean, if the minimal length got shorter and shorter, which I don't see why it couldn't, that solid curve is going to get closer to that dotted line, right? Yeah.
Right. But the minimal length deviates from the inverse of the fundamental scale significantly. Like, you can push it up to wherever that force you could use.
Yes. Yeah.
But for this, I guess you have assumed that it is just the inverse.
Yeah.
And these production cross sections are for neutral particles forming black holes. Well, that's what's typically done, because charge suppresses these facts as well. If you have charged particles colliding, it suppresses the process.
Well, the neutrino is neutral.
Yeah, I know the neutrino is, but often these things are, if you have
yeah,
two neutrinos
yeah.
colliding, maybe, but in general, charge effects suppress these things.
Okay, this is neutrino nucleus.
Yeah, neutrinos are weak charge, though, so that'll also suppress.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. There has been a lot of discussion about this production cross section for black holes.
Mm-hmm.
This is under debate, of course.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not your last slide.
No. I'll just show you under the assumption that the minimal scale is on the same order as the fundamental mass scale. Okay. Okay, this is where I was. This is where the black hole production comes in when you switch on extra dimensions. And you see it becomes dominant. But when you look at the effects of a generalized uncertainty principle under this assumption, this production cross-section goes down dramatically, which is another way of seeing that that GOP suppresses black hole production. And you can also go one step further. You can look at real predictions for an experiment. And okay, we want to go to the through that. This is basically this is the fundamental scale in GEV, and this is the number of black hole events they would see per year in ice cube.
How would they see a black hole?
Yeah, that's another question, actually.
Do you would you have to assume that? I mean, either the energy is lost completely, or you assume that they evaporate instantly and it's simply thermal.
Well,
or what is the assumption? What do they assume for LHC black hole production? Is this, there must be one dominant channel.
I think the most dominant channel is missing energy.
Actually. Missing energy?
Yeah.
So they do not assume that they simply evaporate and thermalize energy?
They do. They have been numerical calculations about what it looks like. There is a fairly recent...
The thermality of the event is the thing to look at.
There is a fairly recent...
How much energy is missing that will depend on the amount that is evaporated into gravity. This is the energy that is missing. I mean, if the black hole evaporates, it evaporates in all particles, and of course also gravitons. But the gravitons are not detected, so this makes a missing energy. But what makes a very clear signature is the thermality of the event. I mean, it has a very high temperature, which is typically like several hundred GeV.
Now, but wouldn't you assume that your minimal length description also modifies Hawking radiation?
So, for
really making predictions for experiments, you have to go one step further, not only compute the cross section, but also the signal they
have to see, of course. I'm assuming here that they can distinguish a black hole event from a normal neutrino nuclear event in their collider.
The same way they would without a minimal length.
Yes.
Which is not necessary.
Yeah. Okay, this is the plot with the modified uncertainty principle, and you see that the number of black hole events goes down a lot. Okay, as I'm running out of time, there's just one thing I wanted to mention. I've tried to tamper with thermodynamics or with statistical mechanics with a generalized uncertainty principle, and this is just something I've done very recently, and it's basically you have seen this suppression factor in momentum space. And what happens when you look at the sum of states, then you get the suppression factor, of course, in your state space, and you can look at I've looked at ultra relativistic particles, and basically what you have is you have your state space. And then you have the suppression factor we have seen before. And I have calculated through this, and I have tried to get to some of course what you do is you go on, you calculate free energy, and you calculate the derivatives, and then you get your thermodynamic equations. And there's two things I want to mention.
Mark, I don't understand this more. I thought the modification was only in internal lines and diagrams. So say it's just three particles, and you still have exponentially minus epsilon.
That's a good question. Well,
if there are three particles, they don't interact. They don't. In equilibrium state. So.
Yeah, but then the suppression factor shouldn't be.
Have equilibrium of photons, three photons.
I mean, the thing that goes in here, I mean, basically you use some kind of box, and you look at which wavelength, which states can you have in this box.
So where is the exponential?
Actually,
what you do is,
if you look at this in the k-space, yeah, this goes away, okay, but your integral is limited to k's that are below one over this fundamental length. That would be the idea.
Why do you use the classical partition function?
As I said, I did this some weeks ago. I just wanted to throw it in to get some response to it. This is not like...
Because one is interested in large energies, large momentum, mm-hmm. so you would think it'd be very quantum mechanical, but very low
quantum, yes, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So it was the opposite.
That was actually the next step I would go there. This is some ultra-relativistic gas, of course, but it's not a quantum gas.
True.
Just two things that come out of there. If you do this, then you get the same equation of state. The equation of state is not modified in this case, but the entropy is modified. That's what you get out of it. The entropy, basically, the entropy saturates with the temperature. In this case, that's what comes out, and that's actually the last thing I wanted to say.
So, what I want to open up a can of worms again, but I guess it will. Back to what Renaud was saying. Okay, so you put in MF to be the smallest it can be and agree with other experiment. What are you putting in for the minimal length to get those suppressed curves? You have to put in some value. How is that value determined?
That value is, of course, determined by over MF.
Well, so you're assuming that's
value.
1 over MF.
Yeah. But of course, that's just.
But of course, it's a factor over MF.
Let's say this is. This, of course, is a very special assumption in the case where you rely on the phenomenology of large extra dimensions, where you look at black hole physics. I mean, of course, in the case of this is just a limit on your fundamental length scale, because this doesn't rely on any physics that is related to black hole production or whatever. So you get a clean limit on this LF. The question, of course, that you might raise is that what if the minimal length and fundamental mass scale of gravity are related in another way?
Yeah.
And then you have, of course, two parameters. That's true. That's true.
Well, I would have thought phenomenologically you could take. I mean, since in general they're not necessarily related, are there not other experiments that can tell us the largest that LF can be, and then could we use that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, for example,
independently, you could just ask what does L, forget about large extra dimensions, just ask how is LF constrained currently by experiment?
Of course.
So what is the constraint on LF in current experiment?
Well, one constraint would first come from here, and I'm just working on a constraint through neutrino oscillations.
Yeah. Number. Yeah.
I think the best number I could for neutrino oscillations it's not much. It's in the GeV range, but
you've got to do better than that with magnetic moment or something.
Yeah, with the magnetic moment, you see that you have like 500 GeV, but the result relies on the first order approximation.
Well,
so you would
LF.
Need,
I mean, LF.
Yes.
There's a different physics or phenomenology.
Yeah. Okay. This is. I mean, you could. I mean, this is a constraint that doesn't rely on. Actually, if I should better write this as m squared times LF squared.
because this is really a calculation that just comes from the modified uncertainty principle. Okay.
Yes, so it is,
but of course, here you have the problem that you rely on the first order approximation. So you would need some kind of a high energy experiment so that you can use the approximation around the expansion around infinity, where you have a far better bound.
Can I ask just a question maybe to you and Sabine, if either of you has thought about how these minimal length models would modify the early universe cosmology?
Well,
we never.
Other people in the room.
Yeah,
it hasn't been done.
Okay.
So, observationally, the furthest back we can go in cosmology is primordial nuclear synthesis.
Right.
So you essentially free play with
whatever. No, I meant what would the Hubble evolution differ by? If you're shut, in some sense, you're kind of shutting off particle propagation on very short scale.
And what you find is that the modes, cobalt modes, so it's have a static time because if there's no length shorter than a minimum length, then each cobalt mode has a starting time, the time when it's propagating towards the length, whatever the cutoff length is.
No, so I understand in the framework of perturbations, but I thought just the background evolution, in his case, he has a minimal length, which is much longer than our naive Planck scales. So you would think that when Hubble gets to the scale of LF, then I don't know what happens.
Right. Yes, and you change the equation of state. You can look at whether you get some varying speed of light effects depending on how you define the effective speed of light in this theory. That has been looked at by Rao's equation.
Right.
They played with this a
little bit. Right.
There are a couple of funny effects, but it doesn't. It's not a compelling new cosmology that you get out of this.
But also, I mean, if the cutoff length was much larger than, I mean, it was a TV or so, I don't know how that would work with inflation.
It's pretty messy because the question is when the scenario with the stabilized large extra dimensions would actually be valid. So you have to worry about how the extra dimensions are
going to be. So inflation doesn't work with fully stabilized large extra dimension at all. There's plenty of problems with inflation, and unless you shrink the extra dimensions roughly at the same time. So there are a couple of ways out of this, but basically if you simply leave everything else unchanged in the extra dimension scenario, try to connect inflation on top of this. It was pointed out very early after ADD, after the ADD.
Mm-hmm.
But also, even if you don't assume any extra dimension, you just assume that the Planck length was really large, it can't make it work.
You can.
There are. Whether it's a Planck length or a TV or something.
Well, push the Planck length down. You can't push the Planck length down that far, can you?
How do you do that? Well, phenomenologically, you can, I think.
There's no extra dimensions, just.
No, wouldn't it? Oh,
no, zero. No, free space dimensions, that's it. How far down can you push the Planck length and have inflation work? I bet, not very.
No.
Yeah. That's the point. That's the point.
Okay.
That's all we need.